Hello again and welcome, everyone. We're very excited to have you with us and to have Dr. Owen Lawson with us. My name is Dr. Akram Khatir. I'm a professor of history here at North Carolina State University, where I also serve as a director of the Moiz Khairallah Center for Lebanese Diaspora Studies. So thank you for joining us for this episode of Tariq, which is our webinar series where we explore the history of Lebanon and its diaspora through conversations with outstanding scholars. In these discussions, we hope to gain deeper insights into Lebanese history in all of its dimensions, be they political, economic, cultural, environmental, or social. Our focus will primarily be on the modern history of Lebanon across the 19th and 20th centuries, but we will certainly make forays into earlier periods as well. If there are particular topics that you would like to hear more about, then please let us know by emailing us at lebanesestudies@ncsu.edu. And now I'd like to turn a little bit to introduce who we are as a center. So we will share with you our mission statement. And so before we begin again, I would like to share a little bit about our mission at the Khairallah Center. We are dedicated to research about Lebanese immigrants in the United States and throughout the world, and to preserving and sharing that knowledge with the scholarly community and general public. In today's webinar, titled Development and Environmental Justice in 20th Century Lebanon, we are absolutely privileged, and I'm absolutely delighted to be speaking with Dr. Owen Lawson, who is a historian of environment, imperialism, and social movements in the modern Middle East. He's currently a SSHRC postdoctoral fellow in the Department of History at the University of Toronto, where he's completing his first book, Power Failures, Development, Sovereignty, and Environmental Justice in Lebanon. Owen serves as co-editor of Arab Studies Journal and co-editor of the Jadalia Environment page. He received his PhD in history from Columbia University in 2021 and holds degrees from the American University of Cairo, Concordia University in Montreal, and he has also taught at Columbia University and Oberlin College, and through Columbia and Cornell University's prison education programs. In this conversation, we will explore the history of various efforts to develop the Litani River in Lebanon between 1918 and 1978. This history of hydropower and development serves as a case for understanding the unequal distribution of infrastructure and its concomitant economic benefits in Lebanon, and the counter efforts by a group of Lebanese nationalist engineers, as well as other activists, to use such large-scale projects to resolve deeply seated inequalities between Lebanon's various regions and religious communities. Now I turn to our guest. Welcome, Owen. It's such a pleasure to have you here. I'm absolutely delighted.
Thank you so much, and for such a kind and generous introduction as well. It's a real pleasure to be here, especially to get to speak virtually at the Khairallah Center, which I just think is such a model for engaged scholarship, you know, a real example of how to do public-facing work, public-facing archives. So it's just, you know, it's a real privilege to be here.
Thank you so much for saying that, and I really appreciate it. And I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while, not least of which because electricity is still not on in Lebanon. So I really want to get to the roots of all of this. But before we get to the heart of your work, really, which is absolutely brilliant and path-breaking, I wanted to ask a little bit about you personally, and about to get to know you a little bit better about the path that you took to become a Middle East historian.
Well, my interest in studying the Middle East and North Africa really emerged in tandem with my expanding political consciousness around the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, which was really a formative moment, in part because of the, you know, explosion of a very disturbing trend of Islamophobia and anti-Arab racism in North America, as well as I just remember being so frustrated with the kinds of stories that I was hearing about Iraqi history, the kind of motivations for this particular moment and explanations of it. I found so dissatisfying, right? So I was very excited to pursue a kind of humanistic study of the people and cultures and societies of this, you know, very diverse and capacious region. So I started doing that in my undergrad at Concordia, and I was very fortunate to find a really extraordinary mentor in Wilson Jacob, who's a historian of modern Egypt, gender and sexuality, mostly in modern Egypt. And, you know, he was the first of several really phenomenal mentors that I've had that have been, I think, what has propelled me more than anything through my academic trajectory. So that's Wilson and then Shireen Sai Ali, Ziad Aburish, Nadia Sabeti, the latter two of which I know are also speaking as part of this series. And along with that, you know, that moment of mentorship was the uprisings across the Arab Middle East in 2011 that became known as the Arab Spring, which I still consider to be, you know, the most exciting moment of political possibility of my lifetime. So on the strength of all of that, I moved to Amman, Jordan in 2011, where I started learning Arabic, and then in 2012 to Cairo, where I lived until 2014, doing a master's at the American University in Cairo. And so those years, of course, 2012 to 2014, were an extremely tumultuous and important moment, defining moment maybe in recent Egyptian history, where I arrived the same week that Mohamed Morsi's election was finalized. And then I left about 6 months into the present military government. And so, you know, it was an extraordinary kind of political education as well as an opportunity to experience the moment of intellectual and cultural flourishing that took place after the revolution in Egypt. So those were the experiences that I think really, grounded me, made my interest really flourish and encouraged me to pursue a PhD.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Can you tell us a little bit about what was your impetus in writing your manuscript, Power Failures, Development, Sovereignty, and Environmental Justice in Lebanon?
The current book manuscript I'm working on emerges out of my dissertation. It's a kind of capacious reworking of the dissertation. And the impetus for that was really, it came out of the archives. It came out of the work I was doing actually beginning with my MA thesis at AUC when I first started to visit Lebanon, and I fell in love with the country and made friends and began to learn with some of the faculty and intellectuals in Beirut, particularly at the American University in Beirut, and get acquainted with some of the nuances of the kind of the landscape of historical primary sources that are available in Beirut and in Lebanon more broadly, which maybe we can talk about more as well. And that project was about Mandate Lebanon. It was an environmental history of aspects of Mandate Lebanon. And when I was reviewing some of the sources for it, I found all of these Lebanese engineers and economists in the 1930s and 40s talking about water and how water was Lebanon's most precious natural resource and was really going to be the key to Lebanon's post-colonial economic sovereignty. And so I knew there was a story about 1940s and 1950s about water development, but I didn't really see it in the historiography of 20th century Lebanon. So when I began my PhD research, I immediately came across the Latani Project. And Latani Project was Lebanon's largest development project until the 1990s, until essentially the reconstruction after the war. It was a large dam irrigation and hydroelectricity scheme on the Latani River, Lebanon's largest river. It was also, very important in terms of its kind of international and regional significance in the moment. It was a central aspect of French and U.S. Soft power efforts in the decolonizing Middle East more broadly. It became an important facet of the Arab-Israeli conflict, the kind of hydropolitics that emerged in the 1950s. And it inaugurated what's proven to be a very durable relationship between Lebanon's governing institutions and the World Bank. And arguably, the World Bank is one of the most important institutions operating in Lebanon today. So, I found this very significant project, many people in the 1950s talking about it. But then if you look in many of the histories of Lebanon that cover those periods, the coverage of the Latani Project is very odd because it's often mentioned only briefly. Sometimes it's mentioned briefly and some of the fundamental facts are incorrect. The dates are wrong. The people who built it are wrong and so on and so forth. Or in some cases, it's not mentioned at all, even in very important works on the political economy of Lebanon in the 1950s and 1960s. It could be absent. And I was completely, just struck by this major historiographic question about how do we explain the absence of the Latani Project in these histories, as well as, which led me to these other questions where, the kind of conventional narrative of Lebanese political economic history after independence in the 40s and 50s is of, laissez-faire liberal governance and a focus on, improving the services in the banking sector and not really much interest in rural development, not really much interest in agriculture, even though so many people, their livelihoods depended on agriculture. And then you have the Latani Project, which is a rural development scheme, right? That required an outsized loan from the World Bank, precisely the kinds of things that the Lebanese government in the histories that you might read of the 1950s says that it's really not supposed to be doing, right? So how do we explain the existence of this mega project in this period when Lebanon was, you know, particularly in comparison to places like Egypt or Syria or Turkey, was nominally pursuing a much kind of smaller state governing style.
That sounds great. So before we delve more deeply into the project itself, I'm wondering if you can just lay out for us the argument after your research and what you're trying to argue in terms of this book. So what is kind of the meta narrative that you're developing here?
So the book is different. I shared with you, Akram, that my dissertation, the book does take a slightly different argument, which is focused around question of resource development and sovereignty. What's the relationship between these two, particularly in the 20th century, in the early part of the 20th century? And essentially what I argue is that natural resource development was a pivotal strategy that states and communities, popular groups could use to establish some kind of territorial sovereignty, right? Not in the sense sovereignty, in the sense of the kind of high legal sense, but in more in the terms, the kind of practical terms that someone like Sarah Pursley talks about in the context of Iraq, of building, you know, realistic, tangible kind of control over a particular territory. And I look at, I'm thinking through this category, this term, which I've kind of come up with, of effective sovereignty, which was the idea that, you know, that a state or a community could acquire sovereignty, could demonstrate sovereignty over territory by putting resources to maximally efficient use, by damming rivers, by drilling oil, by putting agricultural fields to maximally productive use. That was a way of both kind of building sovereignty within the territory and also telegraphing to potential competing powers that, you know, that this territory had an effective sovereign over it. And that's particularly important in places like the Litani River Basin, which has been a kind of contested borderland throughout the 20th century. I look at a number of these kinds of key moments where this strategy of effective sovereignty plays out, beginning in 1919 at the Paris Peace Conference, where the French and the British empires are trying to divide up Ottoman Syria and are looking at the Litani River as a potential border, right? And making claims over who should have control of the Litani River based on who had the greatest need for it and who was most capable of putting it to efficient use. Then in the 20s and 30s, you see Lebanese engineers turning this into a kind of anti-imperial argument, saying that because the mandate state, the French mandate imperial state in Lebanon, was failing its responsibility to rationally develop the Litani River, that the Lebanese nation had to acquire post-colonial sovereignty and to put it to efficient use, and it would be the cornerstone of Lebanon's economic sovereignty because it could generate electricity for industry and also increase agricultural yields. And then you see flashing forward quite a bit, in the 1960s, the emergence of a popular Shia movement in and around the Litani River Basin, making similar arguments against the Lebanese state, saying that the Lebanese state had failed its responsibility to properly develop the Litani River, so they should reacquire some kind of popular sovereignty over its use, over the disposal of its waters. So I see this idea of effective sovereignty playing in kind of a few key moments in across the middle part of the 20th century.
That sounds great. And we're going to delve into some of those in a bit. But for our audience who may not necessarily be familiar with what we're talking about in terms of the Litani River, and I apologize, I had thought about pulling up a map. But could you possibly describe what we're talking about here in terms of geography and what is this, Litani River Basin?
Yes, absolutely. Maps are so helpful. And I do a kind of historical analysis, some of the cartography, which is, of course, cartography, as historians of cartography would say, is not a neutral science, right? It's always kind of projecting something. But essentially, the Litani River Basin it runs through the middle and southern part of the Beqa Valley in the eastern part of Lebanon, sort of parallel to the border with Syria. And then at the bottom of the valley, it curves very sharply towards the Mediterranean west, where it runs through South Lebanon through to the coast at an area that's called Qasimiyah. So it's used for irrigation, all these banana groves just north of the city of Sur, of Tyre, for irrigation there. It was, you know, it's well within Lebanese territory, the territory defined within by the creation of Colony Ball in 1920. But at the same time, I describe it as a contested borderland, in part because it's always been there's been always a tension between initially the Zionist movement and the State of Israel and Lebanon and the Arab League around the disposal of the Litani River, as with many people, I think justifiably concerned that at some point the Israeli state might occupy parts or all or part of the Litani Basin, which ultimately in 1978 does actually take place until 2000. So it was an important kind of locus of international attention, particularly in the middle part of the 20th century, because, you know, for a number of different reasons, that it fit in, I think, very nicely with a broader American and World Bank interest in river basin development, as well as the kind of excitement about river basin development in the Arab world, in the global South more broadly, where a lot of countries really focused on the potential of river basin development as a kind of panacea or a kind of a means to fulfill the promise of meaningful decolonization, right? Not just changing the flag, not just, you know, establishing your own parliament, but really being able to build up a sovereign, you know, economic system that was self-sufficient.
Right. Thank you so much. Just out of curiosity, and I don't know if you have those numbers on, I mean, how the volumes that go through this river, I am sure they've changed over time, but I assume it's a fairly massive volume of water that's going through it.
It is. Well, so in comparison to the kinds of rivers that were subject to similar kinds of projects in the 1950s and 60s in Syria, the Tabqa Dam on the Euphrates, the Aswan High Dam on the Nile, those are much, much, much bigger rivers. So people will, and I think I might have actually just slipped of the tongue, and people will sometimes describe the Litani project as a mega project. And I think that's a little bit overstating it. It's a very complicated infrastructure project. It was extremely expensive, is extremely nuanced. You know, it generated all these kinds of interesting politics, which I think are very important. But in terms of the scope, the river is actually much smaller than some of the kind of major defining rivers of the Middle East. And that has a kind of, you know, that had an interesting part to play in why it was so attractive to Lebanese engineers and entrepreneurs in the Mandate period, is because it wasn't really developed during the Ottoman era the way that some of the other rivers were. And there weren't the same kinds of claims to it in terms of usufruct rights. There weren't the same kinds of claims to the river, because in the Beqa Valley, most of the water supply, most of the irrigation comes from, then and now, comes from mountain springs, right? Most of the major towns and villages and cities in that area are all fed by snowmelt and rainfall, rather than the Litani, which was kind of, didn't have that defining quality the way that the Nile does, where the Nile is really a defining feature of agricultural life in Egypt. It was slightly different, and which made it I think, appeal to engineers as a tabula rasa, like as a natural space they could really make their own.
Well, speaking of engineers, I think we should delve into the history of the development. Obviously, you know, we're not going to have time to talk about the whole spectrum of it. So I'm going to try to skip the mandate and really just focus on the immediate post-independence era. And so I was wondering if you can begin talking about this term that you say, so many or too many experts. You title your chapters "Too Many Experts," in which you are bringing together a whole cast of actors and you're putting them in conversation and competition with each other. And I'm kind of curious about this period, this like 1946 forward, that first phase. Who are these actors and what were they trying to do with this Litani River Basin?
Yeah, it's it's a remarkable moment, really, between 1946 and 1954, where the Litani River in particular, as well as rivers in the Eastern Mediterranean more broadly, are just the site of an extraordinary amount of research and study by, you know, by Lebanese, by Arab engineers and geologists and various different kinds of researchers, as well as by a number of different international missions. So in the 1940s, the Lebanese state nationalizes a former concessionary organization under the mandate, which becomes its water service. And the water service performs a number of major research projects that lead to the kind of the basic research that will then form the basis of the Litani project as it actually emerges. And that's mostly done by Ibrahim Abdelal, who, you know, was the kind of synonymous with the Litani project in the 1950s. He was a prominent Lebanese hydro engineer, civil engineer, and also kind of an intellectual figure. He was very engaged in the political debates, cultural debates taking place in Beirut. At the same time, a kind of an interesting contest emerged amongst various Lebanese engineers and entrepreneurs, each of whom is also kind of backed or seeking the support of different embassies, of the US embassy, the French embassy, the British, the Germans at different points, for their respective plans in order to primarily, you know, it's a contest between the Ministry of Public Works that's kind of emerging in the post-colonial state, and then concessionary developers. So under the mandate, I know we weren't going to talk too much about the mandate, but it does set the terms for it, right? Under the mandate, the main way that the mandate state, the imperial state, pursues development of natural resources as well as all the infrastructure is the concession, which is a monopoly. These are almost all granted to French or Belgium or otherwise European companies in the mandate period. And so there's the real question that's facing, you know, Lebanese engineers as well as state builders in the 1940s and 1950s is, what are the terms of development for the 1950s? Is it going to be a continuation of this concessionary form where private companies get monopoly rights to a particular resource? Or are we going to pursue some kind of central planning, you know, nationalization of resources, national development strategy? And if we're going to do that, what are the terms that it's going to be under, right? So there's a huge amount of political contestation amongst not just engineers, but really a number of different groups. And then at the same time, you have all of these international missions. Initially, there are US and British international researchers who are, you know, seeking at the end of the French mandate to get a toehold in Lebanon and Syria, which had formerly been monopolized by France, right? Formerly, you know, these engineers from other, you know, quasi-imperial powers didn't have access to it. And then after 1948, after the Palestinian Nakba, after the establishment of the State of Israel, there's a huge amount of international interest from various parties to pursue some kind of peace building, you know, normalization process through diplomacy, hydro diplomacy, through, you know, either development works that that were shared across borders between Israel and the Arab states, its neighboring Arab states, or in the form of water sharing agreements, particularly. And you see these negotiations emerge in the 1953 around the sharing of the Jordan River Valley, which are extremely politically contentious. And in the mix, again, there's so many characters here. The reason I call it Too Many Experts is because, you know, it in part expresses my own frustration in trying to put together all the different interests at work in this moment. At the same time, you have point four. So point four is the U.S. It's the first U.S. overseas development aid agency that emerges through, you know, the Truman's famous speech in 1950. And point four, their Lebanon is a very early priority for them. They really see Lebanon as a potential ally in a Middle East that they see potentially taking a more radical route towards decolonization. They see Lebanon as potentially a strong kind of anti-communist ally. So they invest a ton of resources in establishing the Point 4 Middle East headquarters in the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, and they plan to use all of their development work in Lebanon as a kind of showpiece to try and persuade less friendly governments in other parts of the Middle East to accept U.S. aid. And the Latani project, their interest in the Latani project is definitely a piece of that, right? So their perspective is very interesting. The point four important characters in some of my research, and I've done a lot of research in the U.S. National Archives, and point four are really limited from their outset because Truman declared that the U.S. was going to get into the business of helping develop the Global South, but the U.S. Congress immediately limits the budget of point four. So they have a very small budget to work with, and they're also operating in Lebanon, where there's a massive amount of political opposition to the idea that, that people are very concerned that Lebanon will go from being a French imperial territory to more or less being a kind of, satellite state of the United States. So there's a lot of opposition to their operations in Lebanon as well. For 4.4, because of these congressional restrictions, the mandate that they adopt is that they're only going to provide expertise. And they go around saying in their propaganda that what the Global South lacks is expertise. So what Lebanon needs, according to their kind of policy documents, is expertise. They need engineers, they need economists from the United States to come there. And when they actually go to Lebanon in 1951, they're immediately disabused of this, because Lebanon by 1951 is, there's two major, the two largest engineering colleges in the Middle East are based there at AUB and ISIB. And there's just a huge number of engineers who can't get work, right? There's a huge number of Lebanese engineers who are then going and finding work largely in the petroleum industry in the Gulf. So again, there's just an incredible, people often talk about the lack of planning expertise in Lebanon in the early part of the 1950s. And I really see it as the opposite, right? It's more that there was tremendous human capital, but it just, was buckling against particular state conditions where they, where engineers weren't invited into higher positions of power.
So you have all these people, both local and even within the local community, you have different engineering groups with different visions. You have external forces, primarily the United States, as you just elucidated. And what exactly are they trying to do with the Litani River? I mean, what do they want to do as part of this modernization push on everybody's part? Like, what are they imagining? What is their vision for it here?
So, I think there's different perspectives from different groups that were very much in contention. And I think in certain ways, some of the divergences were really quite substantial. As I said, there was a number of Lebanese businesses that were trying to seek concessionary control over the Litani and essentially wanted to continue the practice under the mandate of acquiring monopolies over particular sectors of business or over particular natural resources, very much just switching it from those being Lebanese, from being French concessionaires to being Lebanese concessionaires. Then there were a number of engineers, Lebanese engineers, that were statists. They were people who were very much involved in the kinds of technocratic idealism that drove, Nasserism in Egypt and similar kinds of movements in Turkey and Syria, right, where, there was an idea that engineers and doctors and these kinds of people in the professional classes who had real technical skills were going to be the ones to be able to build, a meaningful kinds of future for the country. And a lot of those people, it's interesting, they were primarily concerned with urban-rural inequality. So, the history of Lebanon and social divisions in Lebanon is very often told in sectarian terms. But in the early 1950s, the people who are planning, to try and think about Lebanon's social and economic problems and how they can potentially resolve them through resource development, through economic development, are much more concerned with the idea that there's an incredible flourishing in Beirut and people are getting very, very wealthy in Beirut, and then the rest of the country is being left behind. And there's a kind of symmetrical relationship right there that the rise of the service industry, the service sector in Beirut, is coming at the expense of the agrarian margins, particularly places like the Litani River Basin. And you know that was really explosive because most people in Lebanon, well into the 1960s, most people derived most of their livelihood through agriculture. So they were very invested, people like Ibrahim Abdel-Al, in building a kind of urban-rural balance through infrastructure and through investment and development in the agricultural margins, right? Through rural electrification, through rural potable water distribution, through expansion of irrigation. And they really hoped that the Litani project was a way to accomplish all of that. And then something really significant happens in 1955, which is that a new player enters into this process, and that's the World Bank. And the World Bank have a very different agenda. They have actually a quite different agenda than the United States and Point Four as well, which I think is significant because I think people who know about the World Bank in the context of the Washington Consensus of the 1980s think of the World Bank as kind of just another US institution representing the interests of the US government. And particularly in the 1950s, when the World Bank had just been founded, they really had their own, problems, they had their own concerns that they were trying to pursue. So their main issue was that they had been founded as part of the Bretton Woods negotiations, as the bank that was going to fund European reconstruction. But then the US introduced the Marshall Plan, and the World Bank was kind of at a loss for what it should do with its capital and all this institutional power that it acquired. So it gradually turns to lending to the Global South, lending to newly post-colonial countries. And again, they see Lebanon as a very exciting early partner, a place where they can go and they can do some really satisfactory loans that will benefit Lebanon, that will benefit them, and will also telegraph to the world that lending to the Global South could be done profitably, that it wasn't just incredibly risky to lend to these potentially revolutionary governments huge sums of money. So the World Bank reorganized the Litani Project plans that were out there, and there were lots of different ones. They reorganized the plans around profitability, around financial soundness, and then more or less maintained control over the Litani Project from 1955 until the completion of the infrastructure in 1965. And I argue that the kind of control that they derived through their loan and also through their work with their Lebanese proxies is very much akin to concessionary control. So, we see under the mandate, these are these concessionary monopolies. We see a huge amount of contestation for about a decade between 1945 and 55 over whether concessionary development would persist. And then the World Bank comes in and more or less reasserts a very, very similar kind of concessionary control through acquiring essentially a de facto monopolization of the Litani River.
So I want to delve a little bit deeper into that, especially with the World Bank. You talked about this transition in which in 1955, the World Bank is coming in, it's beginning to fund it, and it's looking primarily about this as a profitability, something to do with the financial policy. So the Litani River as a project, was it from the beginning thinking that they are going to build a dam, and that dam is going to produce electricity, and that electricity is going to feed into Beirut? And at the same time, they're going to channel some of its waters as potable water to Beirut and potentially to the surrounding areas. Is that the image that they has that been a consistent notion of what the project is, or was that a contested thing as well?
It was. It's start to finish contested, right? And that's it. That's where it gets so. A huge amount of the work I did in the dissertation was just trying to sift through what actually happened versus all of the many narratives about what should happen or could happen or might happen. Essentially, there's a way of writing the history of infrastructure projects which identifies one version of the plan as the plan, the actual one, and then evaluates essentially what happens by the end of that process against that initial plan, right? And in that sense, you have kind of a firm grounding in, you know, what this project is supposed to be versus what it actually ends up being. You know, sometimes, you know, it's successful, sometimes it's not successful on those terms. But the approach that I was kind of forced to take is a little bit more, I would just describe it in a word as like death of the author, essentially, that it's very difficult to point to any particular version of Latani planning and say that, you know, this was really the one that encapsulates what the project was supposedly about. But I would say that, you know, there's an important disjuncture that happens between the kind of political narrative and the way that journalists and politicians in Beirut understand the Latani project and its goals, and also the way that, you know, people in the Latani River Basin understand it and its goals, as well as, you know, what the World Bank is doing, what the World Bank is actually building, you know, in this project, where the kind of contestation amongst Lebanese engineers in the early part of the 1950s sets strong expectations that this is going to be a project that will provide electricity and water both to the Latani River Basin regions as well as to Beirut, and will have all these kinds of positive effects throughout the country. And, you know, the Latani River Authority, the administrative organization that the administrative institution that manages the World Bank loan and oversees the project, they continue to say all the way through to 1965 that that's the case, that that's what the project is about. But then the World Bank, what they're actually building, you know, they redesigned the project in 1955 as a much more narrow project, that it's going to be just one dam. It's going to be organized around producing hydroelectricity. There might be irrigation at some point in the future, and there won't be any potable water. So it's a much more narrow project. And that's the one that actually gets built by 1965. So when you get to 1965, you know, it's very difficult for the Lebanese president at the time, as well as the Latani River Authority, it's difficult for them to build a kind of national story about the dam, about the project, in the way that, you know, the Aswan Dam in Egypt is such a, you know, incredible metonym for the Nasser period and a kind of, you know, such a focus of celebration. They can't build the same kind of narrative around it because it doesn't do the thing they said it was going to do right up until the point where it was completed. So there's this real disjuncture, and there's a sense in which, when, you know, after 1965, more and more people in Lebanon come to understand this, come to understand the distinction, the disjuncture between what the project they believed should be doing versus what it actually did, and that produces all of these very contentious politics.
That's quite remarkable, and which brings us really very interestingly to where there's an explosion of public interest after the Litani scandal in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. I'll get to that, but there's a question that I want to that fits into the infrastructure history that you're building, and it's just a really, you know, kind of a factual question asking if there, aside from the Litani, were there any other important or large infrastructure projects like in Mount Lebanon or the Northern Governorate or the Southern Governorates, or was the Litani it that was really the project?
There were lots. So, you know, Ziad Aboudrish is the person who's done the best work on this, right? That in the early 1950s, the story of the kind of Houthi government is that they were establishing this kind of laissez-faire state and they weren't interested in big development works. But, you know, that's when the airport is built. That's when a number of the kind of Beirut, important infrastructure for Beirut is expanded. And, you know, it's a very important period in terms of electricity generation. You know, at the end of the 1950s, Zoop Mikhail is the second generator there is comes online, as well as the major plant at Jie. So, you know, by the early 1960s, before the Litani project comes online, Beirut actually has a surplus of electricity, if you can believe it, right? It's the period in which Beirut is oversupplied, and actually the rest of the country doesn't have access to the same amount of electricity. Because in the case of, you know, Zahle and the north, they're running on these mandate era concessionary hydroelectricity operations. But there's lots of infrastructure. There's the Autostrad as well, which is partly accomplished through with the help of Point 4. And there's a number of smaller waterworks in the south. There's a project at Taibe, which is brings potable water to a number of villages in the extreme south near the border. They're all smaller, and it is, it's after 1964, 1965 that the kind of large-scale rural development works that were promised by President Fouad Chehab and this kind of Chehabist movement that emerges in 1958, 1959, that moment of rural infrastructure expansion takes place sort of in the mid and late 1960s.
So we have about 10 minutes left before we have to end, unfortunately, although I can keep talking for her. And I have two large questions that I want to pose. So the first one, and I really love how you started this chapter. When you start talking about 1960s, you start out with the scene from the Rahbani Fairuz Jisr al-Amar operetta, this kind of thing that is happening in Baalbek by that time. I mean, if one is talking about infrastructural projects, Baalbek is its own cultural infrastructural projects, and in which she's singing here. And at the same time, you also know that the Abd al-Al power station in Merkaba is opened up, and the ONL, which is the authority that oversees the Litani project, is celebrating it. And there's this kind of like festivities going on about water and hydropower and modernization and kind of what you said, the Shahabist movement. But at the same time, you say the reality, there's something really happening about this narrative that's profoundly different, that the material realities on the ground are very different than all the celebration that's taking place. And so rather than kind of talk in general, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what you term as a Litani scandal, because that really was quite shocking to read about it. I had never heard of this. And the magnitude of the scandal, I mean, the things that happened struck me, really. And I have to say, I think this is the first time anybody has written about it in a real scholarly fashion. So I was very fascinated. So can you talk a little bit about that and what it tells us about the project?
Yeah, thank you for identifying that. Yeah, it took some finding, honestly, to work out the details of that story, but it is quite extraordinary. So in So the ONL or the LRA, they're the Lebanese agency that oversees the management of this project. All of the actual construction and design work is contracted out to various international companies. And they begin construction of the Litani project infrastructure in 1957. By 1958, there's a slowdown in construction, and then there's a massive tunnel collapse. And this, again, it's hard to talk about without a map in front of us, but essentially, the Litani infrastructure collects all of the water of Litani in the middle of the valley at Araun, Lake Araun, and it drains from the lake and goes through a very, very, very long tunnel through Jebel Niha towards the coast. So it cuts immediately west. And the actual Litani River basin below the lake is more or less dry. It accumulates more water as it goes through the mountains. But basically, if you go there, there's the dam, and you can see if you go south of the dam, it's just a dry canyon. So that tunnel was always controversial from a design perspective because it's a seismic area. It was a very, very complicated and ambitious tunnel to try and dig. And I can talk more about why it probably was why it was included, but essentially, it initially collapses, and about a mile of the tunnel gets filled with sand and water, and then it collapses again, and about 3 miles of this tunnel are totally blocked. And this is one of the worst construction accidents anywhere in this time period. It gets written about in the international engineering press. All kinds of professors and engineers from around the world are writing to the LRA and to the World Bank, proposing different kinds of solutions, and they're really not sure what they can do. And this is a moment where the LRA and the Lebanese government really, really get close to scrapping the whole project as it was essentially conceived and overseen by the World Bank. And reworking it entirely as primarily an irrigation scheme that would primarily benefit the Biqa Valley. And that moment, 1958, of course, coincides with the end of the Shamaon government, with the 1958 civil conflict in Lebanon, and then the emergence of Fouad Shahab as the president, and who inaugurates this period, the Shahabist period of massive administrative reform, of expanding the budget, expanding the tax base, and pursuing this scheme of massive infrastructural investment in particularly in rural areas. So for the Shahabists, this is in certain ways kind of a boon, right? Because it means they can really tie a bow around the Shamaon era and say that this is just a horrible scandal that was produced by the preceding government and we're here to solve it. And so what they do is they have this moment called the Latani scandal, in which almost all of the important figures who were involved in the Latani project up until that point, the head of the LRA, the head of the Italian contracting firm that was building the tunnel, and the head of the French engineering firm that designed it, were all put on trial. They were all put on this highly politicized trial right during the same time as the elections, right? So it's extremely politicized, and it is this moment that really takes any lingering like wind, excitement or wind out of the sails of this national project. And what Shahab and what the new incoming board of the LRA that replaced this kind of disgraced board say is that they're going to, you know, more or less overhaul the project entirely. They're going to start afresh, and they're going to do it on the basis of social justice, the way that Shahab talked about most of these projects. They use this term social justice very commonly, and around, you know, trying to fulfill the needs of the deprived agrarian margins. Again, deprived is a term in Arabic, mahrumin, that they used. So they make all these kinds of major public promises. They take a number of practical steps towards that dimension, towards that direction, but they reach the limits of that by when they come up against the World Bank. So the World Bank is very invested in them not altering the scheme, not redesigning the project, getting this tunnel cleared, continuing the project as planned. Because it was, you know, it was very much still trying to pursue its financial interests, its interest in having the loan interest payments and repayment schedule remain in place. And they ultimately win out. They exert pressure through a number of different ways. And ultimately, they do, the LRA agree to just continue working on the project as it was planned in 1955. So this, yeah, exactly. The place where I start that chapter, I think, shows where those two narratives are coming into tension, where the narrative of the possibility of national reconciliation after 1958 through infrastructure development comes up against, you know, questions of sovereignty, questions about the extent to which the government has the capacity to actually make these things happen. And just one last thing about that, there's a question about the timing and periodization. I know, you know, Ziad Abarish is the person who pushes me on these things the most, right? But as I mentioned earlier, you know, Shahab and his cohort, their major accomplishment, and it is major, it's worth reckoning with, is administrative transformation, right? So they totally transform the powers of parliament. They make the executive much more powerful. They gain greater control over the treasury, all these kinds of things. And that stuff really matters. But they're remembered as building, right? They're remembered as this moment of flourishing of the built world. And that really happens later. It really happens under Helou, under the subsequent president. That's when all the stuff actually gets built.
So our final question, again, unfortunately, because we're running out of time, is again back to this narrative. So at various stages, there are people who are looking upon this, whether Abdelal, who was looking at this as a social justice question, whether there are individuals, engineers in Beirut who want to see it as a privatization of resources, the World Bank that is trying to, you know, play out its own vision about the South, the global South development in Lebanon, and, you know, the Shahab narrative as well about the state and its role and all of this stuff about these grandiose projects. But then what we find in the 60s and really into the 70s, especially with Musa Sadr, is a counter-narrative, an attempt, and I don't think that it's the first attempt, but certainly it's the most dramatic and the most, you know, publicized attempt to reclaim that narrative and saying this project isn't about sort of some sort of grandiose element for all the Lebanese. This is a project of severe inequality. It is actually building inequality, and it needs to be transformed. So can you talk a little bit about that? And, you know, where, especially with Musa Sadr, but also Kemal Asad, who was before him.
Yes. Yeah, in 1965, there's the ceremony. There's a ribbon cutting ceremony at the LRA's final power plant that they inaugurate, and it's, you know, celebrating the end of the Latani project per se. Right after this, more or less, the LRA is just going to go through to manage the infrastructure they constructed, as well as maybe do one or two other small projects. But then, just a couple weeks after that, a group of Shia ulama in Bush Hamoud release a statement. And it's actually a statement that was issued by Muhammad Hussein Fadlallah, who, of course, you know, in the 1980s becomes very prominent as the, you know, a instrumental thinker in the movement of Hezbollah. And they argue that, you know, that the Latani project, as it was constructed, is the worst injustice against the Shia community in Lebanon, and that it's specifically an injustice against the Shia in particular, right? So what's happened over the decade, you know, intervening between 1955 and 1965 is a massive agrarian crisis. And this is a kind of agrarian crisis that you see all over the world taking place in these decades, where, you know, agricultural prices fall, and there's a huge amount of emigration into the diaspora, and a huge amount of emigration to Beirut, or I should say first to Bush Hamoud, and then to the areas that become known as the southern suburbs. So there's a massive displacement from these rural areas. And the Latani project is not responsible for that, but it is symptomatic of a broader pattern of disinvestment in agrarian areas and in the rural world more broadly, which Shihabism is kind of trying to respond to. So what you see in 1965 and really onwards is a number of Shia ulama, but particularly Musa Sadr, who then in 1974 will found Harakat al-Mahrumin, which is the, you know, the important kind of Shia political party that, you know, becomes a defining part of the Lebanese civil war, is, you know, his contention is that this is a structural injustice, right? The Lebanese state has set out to extract resources from these communities, that the project should be rightfully reorganized around the needs of the most needy, right, against the needs of those who are deprived. And so there's an effort by this kind of burgeoning movement to reclaim forms of popular sovereignty over the river, to claim that it should be redistributed in the Beqa Valley and in South Lebanon in particular, and as part of a broader project of establishing Shia equality on a kind of sectarian basis in the government, as well as a broader kind of, you know, speaking to a broader kind of agrarian moment, about a broader way in which agrarian or kind of the interest of the impoverished should become central to the practice of governance. And of course, there's a tension there, which I think is really interesting. And it's been more what I've been focusing on more lately, right? Where I think this is, what you see is it's an agrarian crisis that plays out in part on sectarian terms. And then you see a cohort of very dynamic Shia ulama who translate that into a specifically sectarian grievance, who claim it essentially as a kind of Shia grievance rather than a broader agrarian one. And also in the same moment are increasingly claiming the Beqa Valley and South Lebanon and the Latani River Basin quite explicitly as a Shia kind of territory, as a Shia region, despite, of course, as we all know, the incredible religious diversity, the diversity of all kinds in those regions, and the diversity within Shia communities, right? So it's a moment of real of political possibility that's created through this infrastructural injustice.
Oh, and I could go on talking for hours because I think this is an amazing project. And quite honestly and sincerely, I cannot wait for it to come out as a book. So, you know, after you get off this, please hurry up and finish the book because it is going to be a wonderful, wonderful contribution to not only to the history of Lebanon, but really the history of the Middle East in general, the history of development and the, you know, infrastructure history and, you know, various other elements. It's just a really well done manuscript. very impressive, the research that you've done. And thank you so much for being with us today here. Really appreciate it. Thank you, everyone. Sorry, there are some questions that I couldn't get to because I was so immersed in this, so I apologize. We appreciate you being here. And we, you know, as I said, we apologize if we didn't get some of your questions, but hopefully we're able to shed some light on the history of development in Lebanon in the 20th century, as well as provide you with new insights that go beyond the traditional narrative that has been prevalent hitherto. Now, you can sign up for our newsletter and follow us on social media, and you have those here. If you'd like to stay informed about future events, this webinar has been recorded, and we will publish the video within the next 2 weeks on the Khair Allah Center's YouTube channel. We'll also provide this audio as part of our podcast series related to our mission at the Khair Allah Center. You can listen to those episodes on Apple Podcasts. While this webinar concludes our Spring 2023 series, please note that we will be back in the fall of 2023 with more conversations about the history of Lebanon with outstanding scholars like Dr. Owen Lawson. So stay tuned. Finally, we are a nonprofit organization, and we are only able to host these events with the help of our donors. If you enjoy this webinar, please consider donating $5, $10, or $25 a month by following the QR code on your screen. Thank you again for joining us, and we will see you next time. Thank you again, Owen.
Thank you all so much for listening.